The next case is Elk Creek Ranch, KK Ranch versus Western Resource Advocates and others. And it's case number, where is the case number? 2009 CW48, sorry. Are both parties ready?
I'm ready.
Supervisor? I'm going to set for half hour apiece. Appreciate it. First of all, the appellants, please keep track of your time. Secondly, when you address the court, please tell us who you are and who you represent. And lastly, let me tell you about iPads. Some of us have iPads, and we have all the briefs, the records, and we have a link to Westlaw next on them. And we'll be using them, or at least I do. And I'm not surfing the net. No one is surfing the net. So with that, let's begin.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Philip Lopez, and I represent the applicant appellant Yellow Jacket Water Conservancy District. And before I begin, Chief Justice Bender, I just have to correct you that it's Yellow Jacket Water Conservancy District versus K-Bar K Ranch, Western Resource Advocates, etc. With me today is Ms. Sarah Kwan, who is seated at Council's table. And I would like to inform the court that I intend to reserve at least 10 minutes for rebuttal today. This case concerns diligence applications that were properly filed and improperly dismissed. This court should reverse the order of the Division 6 Water Court, dismissing the district's diligence applications and canceling its conditional water rights. The district complied with all legal requirements when it filed its applications in September of 2009. And as such, the application is properly before the water court. And what I would like to do today is first discuss the legal requirements for properly filed diligence application, and then discuss the errors in the water court's order. There are two statutes under the 1969 Water Rights Determination and Administration Act that govern the filing of diligence applications. 3792-302-3014A states that in order to maintain a conditional water right, the owner or user must file an application within 6 years from the previous diligence determination. And 3792-302-1 states, any person who desires a finding of diligence shall file an application with the water court. Now, this court has reviewed these statutes many times before, most recently in Dallas Creek and Getty, and has determined the requirements that must be met under the 1969 Act for a properly filed diligence application. And those requirements are that the application is filed by the statutory deadline in 3792-3014, that there is proper notice in the resume, and that the water rights at issue are properly identified in both the application and the resume. As this court held in Dallas Creek and Getty, this vests the water court with subject matter jurisdiction to proceed with the determination of diligence at trial. And it's important to note that in prior cases in which this court has determined that applications were invalid, concerned applications that were not filed by the statutory deadline in 3792-3014, or did not properly describe the water rights. In this case, the district complied with all of the requirements under the 1969 Act.
Kind of begs the issue, doesn't it? I mean, the allegation is the district didn't comply because it didn't have a valid board in place.
It did have a valid board in place, and it had a valid quorum in place. The water court went beyond Colorado law to determine that the directors from Divisions 1, 3, 6, and 7 were unreasonably holding over, where there is nothing in the language of the Water Conservancy Act that says that. 3745-114-B1 says that if a director can continue to hold over past the expiration of his term, and he, under Colorado law, he's considered a de jure officer. The water court had to go to dicta in three out-of-state cases to determine this reasonableness standard that this court has never upheld and doesn't need to uphold in this case because the board was valid, the board was validly, had a valid quorum, and there's no concern with that issue. And as such, there was no issues in the Water Conservancy Act that the district failed to comply with. The district did everything that it was required to do under the 1969 Act, and the applications were properly before the Water Court.
But the district didn't abide by the idea that you should, in effect, initiate the replacement officers or the continuation of the prior officers through a proper proceeding.
The plain language of the Water Conservancy Act does not limit the holdover provision to other requirements in the...
No, that's that wasn't the gist of my question. The gist of my question is, the board itself has a duty to initiate the filling of the officer positions, right, after the terms of the existing officers are expired or about to expire. Isn't that a duty on the board that they didn't carry out? I'm just asking that. I'm not saying what the consequence is. I'm saying, didn't the board have a duty, probably with the Rio Blanco District Court, I don't know, you can tell me that, to initiate a requirement to have a board in place that continues on the existence of the valid Board of Directors?
The Water Conservancy Act does state that as terms are about to expire, that notice must be filed with the Rio Blanco County District Court.
What's the reason why that district didn't do that?
To be honest with you, things slipped through the cracks. And that happens. This is a rural board. These are farmers and ranchers who are working on this board, probably for low pay. So to the extent that it slipped through the cracks, it happens. But the important thing to note is that the holdover provision of the Water Conservancy Act is not based on whether or not those actions are taking place. The holdover provision specifically states that they will hold over past the expiration of their terms until their successors are appointed. And that's what happened in this case. They continued to hold over until their successors were appointed. And
could I ask you a question? Is there in the materials that we've been supplied, I didn't see it. Are there bylaws of or something like that? Are they part of the record? Other than the minutes?
No bylaws.
There's no bylaws. Just a statute and
just a statute.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Could I ask a question? And then in responding to the, or maybe you could respond to, I think, an argument that your opponents made, and that is, do you then read the statute that you're referring to permit holdover under any circumstances for any length of time? So in effect, are you saying until somebody brings an action to remove a holdover officer that he maintains de jure status or until he's replaced?
Well, in this situation, I don't think that issue needs to be addressed because the court appointed its successors. So there's not an issue that the court has to decide today how long the de jure officer can continue to hold over under the statute.
Well, I suppose it may be relevant, though, with regard to the questions Justice Hobbs was asking, are there any implicit limitations, even though the statute doesn't say them? I mean, and I take it what you're complaining about is the imputation of a reasonableness requirement, but if not that, is there no limitation whatsoever?
The limitation is when an action is brought against them by either the district attorney or another party, and the Rio Blanco County District Court in this case would determine whether or not they continued in a de jure capacity.
Okay, so I take it then that's an affirmative to my question. There is no limitation other than somebody bringing an action and having a declaration that they've held over too long or that they need to be replaced.
Yes.
So is your point that the Water Court has special jurisdiction that doesn't encompass this idea about whether the board is a valid board or not?
That is correct. Water adjudication proceedings are limited special statutory proceedings. And an action regarding the director's holdover would have to be an action that would be brought against them personally. And it's similar to the situation that this court dealt with in the GASP case, because in GASP, opposers were trying to bring an injunction action against the applicant in that case. And this court held that even though the injunction action for preventing them from pumping their wells was still a water matter, it still couldn't be brought in a special diligence proceeding, or in that case, it was a conditional water rights proceeding, because the water adjudication proceedings are very limited, and you can't bring actions against an individual. So it's the same issue in this case. If there was an issue against the directors, that had to be brought against them personally or against the district in its capacity, not in an in-rim water adjudication proceeding, and that's where the water court erred in this situation.
So as a practical matter, are you suggesting then that the opposers here should have brought a quo warranto proceeding in district court and then done what? How could they have obtained the relief that they sought here? Would they then have to take that judgment and bring it to the water court? Or I'm just trying to see how this would play out as a practical matter.
As a practical matter, I believe that is correct. Because if an action was brought against the directors, it was determined whether or not they had a valid holdover or they were unlawfully in office or whatever, then that may be an issue that the water court would have to determine whether or not it divested it of subject matter jurisdiction. But the water court had subject matter jurisdiction because all of the requirements that this court has determined under the 1969 Act were present for the water application. And there was nothing that divested the court of that jurisdiction. Are there any other questions? I will reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Michael Sawyer. Together with my associate Jeff Conklin, we represent water court opposers Joe Livingston, Barbara Livingston, Joan Livingston, the John D. Livingston Trust, Virginia Bean, the Ted Edmonds Revocable Trust, and the Ruth Longwell Evans Revocable Trust. I am joined by Glenn Porzak and Karen Henderson, who represent opposers Elk Creek Ranch Development, the Elk Creek Ranch Owners Association, and the K/K Ranch. Finally, I'm joined by Rob Harris, who represents opposer Western Resource Advocates. In the opposer's arguments today, I will address the district's powers and obligations under the Water Conservancy Act, including the parts of the act governing holdover officers, and finally, the extraordinary remedy of quo warranto. Glenn Porzak will address the water court's ancillary jurisdiction to determine the validity of the district's diligence application. The dispute that the court will decide today is somewhat unique on the court's docket, in that the application of the decision may well be limited to the parties before the court. In this case, the court is primarily required to interpret provisions of the Water Conservancy Act. In particular, the court is called upon to review the Act's provisions that regulate a water conservancy district's exercise of its governmental functions and requirements for appointing members to its board of directors. The reason this decision will likely be limited to the parties before it is the unique set of facts giving rise to this dispute. That is, the expiration of a majority of the terms of a majority of the members of the board of the Yellow Jacket Water Conservancy District.
I just want to be clear of the posture on this now. The reason we're reviewing this question at all, the provisions of the Conservancy Act, is because the water court canceled a diligence water right, correct?
That is correct.
And it canceled the diligence water right based on an inquiry brought to it by your clients.
Correct.
Challenging the status of the board, right? So how does this become a water matter?
Can I just add a piece to that, if I might? And that's under, he rules under his ancillary jurisdiction, right?
Well, the court properly assumed jurisdiction of this case. The applications, water court diligence applications, were filed. The court determined this case on the merits. It conducted an investigation into the validity of the applications filed by it, and the court found that under the Water Conservancy Act statute that the applications were void or ultra vires because at the time they were filed, there was not a properly constituted board in place through which to exercise the district's power.
Wait a second, Ms. Sawyer. So it wasn't under ancillary jurisdiction. Is that correct?
The court undertook its analysis on the merits under its statutory authority to inquire into the
diligence matter.
Okay. Yes.
So holdover officers can't protect the valuable conditional water rights that belong to the district if somehow they're in office a little bit too long.
The statute, the Water Conservancy Act, provides particular conditions for when a director may serve in a holdover capacity. Specifically, the Water Conservancy Act says that a officer may continue as a holdover while a subsequent officer is being duly appointed. The Act has specific provisions as to what constitutes duly appointing successor officers, and that includes publishing notice in a newspaper 60 to 45 days before the expiration of the term of the sitting officer, and allowing applicants to file applications with the district court that organized the Water Conservancy.
My question had to do with a valuable property right, a conditional water right.
And I guess my answer, Justice Hobbs, is that the Act provides when a sitting officer whose term has expired may continue to act in a holdover capacity, and in this particular setting, they did not comply.
But your assumption is the board can't act.
That's correct.
So therefore, the valuable property right of the public that is within the Water Conservancy District, completely loses its property right, even though the application apparently was diligently filed within the statutory time. And can you cite a case where we have canceled a conditional water right based on such an argument?
Well, the court has held that the diligence filing is a statute of limitations, and the failure to file a...
It was filed. The facts are it was filed.
Yes, but
maybe the attorney, recognizing the issues involved and the duty to protect the valuable property rights of the district, got the application timely filed. I mean, that would be... And even a de facto or de jure director, you know, trying to protect the valuable assets of that public district. I mean, that's what we're talking about, right? It actually occurred. What the water court did was look behind it and question whether or not the board had any power whatsoever to protect the assets of the public. Isn't that the problem?
Well, I think that is the issue and the problem for the district, but the legislature, through its enactment of the Water Conservancy Statute, designated the Board of Directors as the exclusive party who has the authority to exercise the rights of the district to maintain water rights. Without a properly constituted Board of Directors, there is not an entity that possesses that statutory authority to file a valid water court application at the time of the diligence requirement.
So, sorry, let me ask you a question. It's an interim proceeding, right?
Water proceedings are interim, yes.
Okay. Do you have a case to cite that if the party seeking an interest in a thing, an interim, has to prove capacity as part of subject matter jurisdiction?
Justice Bender, I don't see this case as one where there was a failure of subject matter jurisdiction.
If it It's not a failure of subject matter jurisdiction, then why isn't, I don't understand how you can argue that the water court was correct.
Because what the water court did was to look in to say, what are the requirements for filing a valid diligence application under the Water Conservancy Act? And the court found that the water court found, and we agree and argue, that for a valid water court application to be filed with the court, there has to be a properly constituted board at that time. There was not.
Oh, that's really an argument about capacity to sue, isn't it?
Isn't that just another way of saying that, that the party's not a real party in interest?
The water rights, I believe, are undisputably held by the Yellow Jacket Water Conservancy District.
When Representative, as Justice Hobbs points out, for the various rights, you know, right, the public rights and so forth. So I guess I don't get it. If you're saying that you look at the petition and determine whether every allegation is true, and that's your argument? But that's really a capacity argument, isn't it?
That is one of the statutory obligations that a water court has, to determine whether the allegations in a water court application are true. And this court, or the water courts on occasion, are required to look beyond what we might consider traditional water issues to determine the truth of the allegations in a water court application. An example would be titled water rights. This court has decided on previous occasions that determining titled water rights is not within the jurisdiction of the water court. However, the water court does have the ability to inquire into whether an applicant has a sufficient claim of title to process a water court application before it. This case is very similar. Court does not have jurisdiction per se over the Water Conservancy Act. However, the court does have jurisdiction, and in fact the statutory duty, to inquire into the truth of the matters asserted in the application.
Can I approach that from just a slightly different angle? I didn't mean to cut you off, but I think we saw what your point was there. But from the briefs on both sides here, it seems that nobody's contesting the fact that these people were officers and they were simply holding over. Is that not right? I mean, you all are challenging the fact that they would at least be de facto officers. They're not imposters. This is not a fraudulent act. This is not a forgery or something, right?
I don't believe we are asserting that there is any fraud or fraudulent act. However, Justice Coates, our argument is that they were not acting as holdover officers because the officers of Yellow Jacket were not sitting in accordance with the holdover provisions in the Water Conservancy Act.
Well, that act, I take it, or I thought your argument was, therefore they weren't de jure officers anymore because of the way, but there's no question about what they're holding over, right? They were, do you dispute the fact that they were officers?
I guess they're going to meetings, which I understand.
Are you disputing their credentials or what?
We are asserting that they are valid officers with the ability to provide the board with a quorum as mandated under the Water Conservancy Act.
Let me follow it this way then. I don't think there's any question here, but this, you are, in effect, it sounds to me, saying that the court had an obligation to make sure the application was properly filed, that those who filed it were allowed to do so. But that, to challenge their credentials, is very clearly a collateral attack on what is at least a de facto officer, it would seem to me. And I guess what I was going to ask you is, I didn't notice in either one of your briefs really dealing with it, but haven't we held for hundreds of years and even recently that you can't attack the credentials of at least a de facto officer collaterally? You have to do it at the time he takes the act, or he does the act. Right. And that's what's kind of worrying me. I don't dispute the idea, or I don't think we need to, that the court has an obligation to ensure that everything that was done properly, as is required. But the question is, does he have to accept the credentials of the officers if they're at least de facto, if they're at least operating under color of authority?
No, I don't believe that the water court does have that obligation. I believe the water court can make a substantive inquiry as to the validity of the application, as it did in this particular case. I think that the jurisprudence of this court regarding de facto and de jure officers has held in previous occasions that where a statute provides a more specific set of criteria for when an officer can hold over, the statute, the legislative enactment, must control. And what we argue in this case is that in the Water Conservancy Act, the legislature did exactly that. It created a more specific set of circumstances under which a holdover officer may continue to exercise the authority granted under the statute, and that can only occur in situations when the district has taken timely opportunity to publish notice that the term of the sitting officer is about to expire, to open it up for applications, and those applications are then tendered to the district court. And there may be a period between when the district court receives the applications and when its docket permits it to get around to signing orders that there may be a need for a holdover officer at a water conservancy district. But in a situation where the district ignores intentionally or negligently its obligations under the act, its officers are not permitted to continue to act in holdover capacity.
I follow it up just to make sure I understand. So that does narrow it considerably what you're arguing is about, strictly with regard to holdover officers. So you wouldn't make the same argument then, let's say, with regard to other credentials of the officer. You wouldn't believe that the water court could consider whether these officers were properly appointed in the first place, whether their notice was given, or whether they were actually allowed to be. Or are you saying you could attack the credentials of those officers no matter what those credentials, the fault in those credentials was?
I guess to be consistent, how I would respond, Justice Coates, is that in a situation where the validity of the application tendered to the water court is called into question, the water court has the jurisdiction and the right to inquire into the substantive basis, and that includes the right to inquire whether, in the case of a water conservancy district, there is a validly constituted board.
So actually, that is broader, I take it. You're saying you could challenge the credentials no matter what they are.
I could see circumstances where that need might be broader than the specific facts of this case brought before.
And let me just do one follow-up to make sure we've got you committed to a position here, that we want to understand what you're arguing. Typically, it seems to me that, you know, the way this doctrine had developed was, you know, I guess you obviously couldn't have a situation in which somebody challenges statute on the grounds that one of the legislators who voted for it was really not properly elected 2 years ago or whatever. So the doctrine, you can't collaterally attack the credentials of at least a de facto officer. We've dealt with it fairly recently, you know, in the last few years with regard to judges, you know, and say, hey, whether a county court judge really, his papers were in order to make him a district court judge. You can't challenge that at the time he acts, or you can't challenge that after the act. You have to do it at the time he acts and say, you're not the right officer, you can't do this. Here, if I'm understanding the situation, we have the board taking action and filing, and then you all coming in afterwards and saying the credentials of one of those officers who filed is defective. We're not arguing he's an imposter, it's just his credentials, he ran out, he was defective. Is there some reason why you think your situation is different from those in which we've said you can't collaterally attack the credentials of a de facto officer?
Well, I think it's important to note that in most of the circumstances where this court has had an opportunity to review de facto de jure officers and their status, there is generally some external body that's empowered to review and put a check on the reappointment process or the election process. So situations where there is an election and the voters elect a new officer, it is not the existing council person who has the ability to determine whether or not they will submit to the reappointment process required by law. Same thing with a judge, you know, the Sherrod case you referred to. In that situation, there was an external check in the sense of the district court judge having the ability to make sure that the appointments were proper and consistent with the law. In this case, it really is up to a water conservancy district board itself to regulate its appointment process. And the act provides its own check on situations where the district doesn't comply with the appointment process mandated by statute. And that check is, if you don't publish notice that terms are coming to an end, if you don't seek applications and have give people the opportunity to tender their application to the district court, you cannot continue to hold over an office. That's the internal check in the act to make sure that the board actually fulfills.
I don't believe what you just said is in that act. In fact, the act says that they hold over until they're appointed. Show me the statutory language that says what you just said.
The act says that the officer holds over until another officer is duly appointed. The act has specific provisions for when an officer is being duly appointed. It requires publication in the newspaper 60 to 45 days before the end of the term of the sitting officer. It requires an opportunity before the term expires for people to submit their applications to the district court. The duly appointment process provided for in the act means you have to undertake that before the term expires for the sitting office.
And then the legislature has provided that everything is void that a public district does if you miss the deadline for giving the notice to fill the particular vacancy. I mean, where is that?
What the act provides is that a district must exercise its powers through a quorum of directors. And where you do not have a quorum, the district cannot exercise its powers.
We're supposed to conclude that the legislature intended that, and that there's a forfeiture of valuable property rights because they failed to do that?
The applicants would have this court decide that there is no consequence to following the dictates of the legislature by failing to abide by the appointment provisions. There are consequences to not following your Organic Act. Your Central Colorado Water Conservancy District case says that. The district must comply with the terms of its organic statute. I'm going to yield the remainder of my time to my co-counsel, Glenn Porzak.
May it please the court. Good morning. As counsel for three entities, the Elk Creek Ranch, the Elk Creek Ranch Owners Association, and then the K/K Ranch, they are landowners within and taxpayers of.
Excuse me, Mr. Porzak, just identify yourself for the record.
Glenn Porzak,
I apologize.
I'm sorry.
You're up.
They are landowners within and taxpayers of the Yellow Jacket Water Conservancy District, and I wish to focus my remarks on the water court's proper exercise of its ancillary jurisdiction in this case. And Justice Bender, the court did exercise its ancillary jurisdiction in rendering its decision. There's a well-known adage that one who lives by the sword dies by the sword. As the water court's order affirmed, the Yellow Jacket Conservancy District is a public taxing entity that only has such powers as its Organic Act grants it or endows. And that organic statute is the Water Conservancy District Act. And the district cannot selectively pick and choose which provisions of the act with which to comply. The court held in the Fort Lyon versus Catlin Canal Company case that's cited in our brief that a water court may exercise ancillary jurisdiction over matters that may affect the outcome of the water case at issue. And the case there dealt with a private ditch company bylaw provision prior to filing a given change application. We submit that the Division 6 water court's exercise of its ancillary jurisdiction in the present case is consistent with that precedent. Specifically, as Mr. Sawyer mentioned, the district needed a properly constituted board to exercise its powers. Those powers included the authorization to file the subject diligence applications. In the Purdue versus Fort Lyon Canal Company case and the Merrick versus Fort Lyon Canal Company case that were both cited in our brief, this court, that the court held that the water court had ancillary jurisdiction to determine compliance with private agreements that affect the validity of a water court application. And in the Dallas Creek and the Getty Oil cases, which are the main cases relied upon by the Yellow Jacket Water Conservancy District, there the court actually went in under its ancillary jurisdiction to determine the status and authority of the applicants to pursue the applications in those instant cases. But most importantly, in the Central Colorado Water Conservancy District case, cited in our brief, this court held that the water court's determination that provisions upheld a water court's determination that provisions of the Water Conservancy Act apply to the given application. And in so doing, I want to quote from that case. This court stated that the district, and I quote, was compelled to obey the mandate of the statute, not only in how the district is formed, but also in how, through its directors, it continues to function. End of quote.
So, Porzak,
yes.
Why don't you sort of answer sort of the question that I asked, as well as Justice Coates. You don't question, you know, there's no fraud involved and so forth, and it's an in rem proceeding. And so it seems why is this subject matter jurisdiction, other than the fact that you have directors that are holdovers, but it can be cured. So why is this a subject matter jurisdiction issue? And putting aside whether it's ancillary jurisdiction or not, assuming it is for a second, what's going on here, and why is the water court deprived of jurisdiction because they have holdover directors which are cured by subsequent acts, right?
Well, thought after the fact.
Well, I mean, it doesn't matter.
These people were holdovers for two.
In rem matter, it shouldn't. I don't quite see that.
First of all, we're not contesting that the court had jurisdiction.
Well, if testing the court doesn't have jurisdiction, then why are we here?
The court had jurisdiction. We've never contested that. But what it did was dismiss the applications on other grounds because they did not have a validly constituted board. And to go on and answer the rest of your question, which also is a question that Justice Hobbs asked, in that Central Colorado Water Conservancy District case, where the court said that it has a mandate to follow the dictates of the Conservancy Act. There, the court then went on to say that by virtue of its failure to comply with the Conservancy District Act, it actually canceled the water rights at issue in that case. There basically said that it was a Trans Mountain diversion and you didn't meet all the dictates that you were obligated to do.
But that was a condition having to do with the actual obtaining the water right. There had to be this mitigation plan, right?
In part, yes.
Yeah, so it totally lacked a provision having to do with the water rights application. I mean, I don't understand how that translates to whether a de facto officer can be a part of a quorum in a timely filing of a diligence application.
Because in the Central Colorado Water Conservancy District case, this court held that that the district has an obligation to obey the mandate in how, through its directors, it continues to function. And it did not have directors. Their terms had expired. If to basically go along with the argument of the Yellow Jacket Water Conservancy District, you're effectively saying that, we're going to get away from the staggered terms. We're going to get away from the term limitation that a director has. We're just going to throw out the window all the different requirements of the Conservancy District Act. So at the time that the applications were required to be filed, they did not, you know, have five out of the nine board members. We're not valid board members. It could have been anybody off the street at that point in time. And they had not taken the initial steps to go ahead and start the procedure, if you will, so that they could be considered in a holdover status.
No, that's, there was a decree, a judgment, order, maybe it's an order, of the Rio Blanco District Court appointing these people to that board, right? Correct?
Yes, but it had expired.
What? The court's order appointing those people expired?
Sure, they can stand for a four-year term. They're supposed to have staggered limits. They're supposed to be appointed according to specific districts, if you will. All that expired.
Counsel, before you move on from that point, can I just ask the same question that was asked of your co-counsel here? Essentially, you're basing your argument, I think, on the fact that this decision or any action is void on the statutory provisions that must be followed to put this board in place, correct? I guess I'm wondering, just to repeat the question to you, there are procedures that I think we all recognize that have to be followed to put a board in place. They weren't followed here. But where do you get from that the conclusion that all the actions taken by this board are void? I mean, in other words, there are procedures, but where do you get the remedy, I guess, to say, to claim that all the actions are void? Where do we get that remedy out of the statute?
In upholding the water court's decision in this case, it simply requires an entity that collects public tax dollars. Keep in mind, this is a public entity that taxes. That they have to be in compliance with their authorizing legislation. As I said at the outset, to live by the sword or die by the sword, they were not in compliance with those requirements. And that's why this case does have very limited application, because it really only, it's not going to affect a normal district, their day-to-day type functions. I represent tons of those districts and municipalities and whatnot. And that's one thing that I really want to make clear is that this, to uphold the water court's decision, is not going to affect those normal day-to-day functions. It only affects a situation where you have a conservancy district that has this specific organic statute, and they totally failed to comply with that. I think I'm out of time. Thank you. No, that's okay. I've got no more thoughts.
Thank you, Mr. Ford.
Thank you very much.
Arnold?
Just a couple of quick points. I want to discuss the central case that the appellees continue to bring up. And I think, Justice Hobbs, you addressed this. The central case involved a specific statutory provision in the Water Conservancy Act that an appropriator who was going to divert water out of the Colorado River Basin had to comply with specific statutory provisions before it could divert water out of the Colorado River Basin. That's not the situation we have in this case. There's no specific statutory requirement in the Water Conservancy Act for any preconditions or conditions precedent that must be followed prior to the filing of a diligence application. And so the language in the central case, I believe the appellees are reading that too broad. That case was very narrow for that specific statutory provision. The other issue I want to bring up is that the appellees continuously argue that the directors are somehow invalidated from holding over as de jure officers under the holdover provision. However, that doesn't stop them from holding over as de facto officers, as Justice Coates, you've brought up numerous times. And I'd like to bring this court's attention to the Consolidated School District v. Angus case, because that has a very similar fact pattern to this case. And in that case, there was a director for a school district who served past the expiration of his term. And he participated in the authorization of a contract for a school teacher. And the validity of the contract was challenged because people who were challenging said that the director wasn't properly in office. And this court held that it did not have to make the decision whether it was a de jure officer or a de facto officer, because under Colorado law, the actions of a de facto officer are as valid and binding as the actions of a de jure officer. So in this case, there's no question that whether they were serving de jure under the holdover provision or they were serving as de facto officers, that they had the authority from their previous appointments under color of title to authorize the filing of the diligence applications. So there's no issue in this case that those applications were not properly filed. And to the extent that this court is concerned with the issues of the holdover or the board, how the board was consolidated at the time the applications were filed, the district ratified the filings in 2007 when they gave the attorney for the district the authority to do whatever was necessary to do to make sure that the water rights continued. And as such, even if there's an issue in the time period that the water court said in this 2009 period prior to the filing, the appellees don't address why it couldn't have been ratified prior to 2009. Are there any questions? All right. Thank you.
I want to thank all the attorneys for your arguments and briefs. The case will be submitted on the briefs.